The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hey, it's The Takeaway for Wednesday, September 28th, 2016. Remember, if you like this podcast, subscribe to us on iTunes and give us a rating. Thanks a lot.
This is The Takeaway, and we begin today on a sad note. Shimon Peres, twice Prime Minister of Israel and the country's 9th president, the last of the great Israeli leaders from the pre-Israeli history of the 20th century, has died at the age of 93. His vision of the Middle East, deeply beloved, something he worked for half of his life after he left the defense ministry and its companies where he helped create the modern Israeli military. Shimon Peres spoke of his vision for Israel during his acceptance speech for the Nobel Peace Prize in 1994.
Israel's role in the Middle East should be to contribute to a great, sustained regional revival. A Middle East without wars, without enemies, without ballistic missiles, without nuclear warheads. A Middle East in which men, goods, and services can move freely without the need for custom clearance or police licenses.
Peres loved speaking to young people, especially at the end of his life. Even though he was never fully trusted to stand up to the Arab world by Israeli voters, he was always upbeat about the lessons that could be learned from politics, even for young people today.
I want to tell you one thing that I'm critical about the young people. They don't want to go into politics. Politics doesn't have a good name. If politics doesn't have a good name, and you believe that politics can be good, go in politics and participate in making a future.
Shimon Peres speaking in the last decade to a TED audience. At a similar event, more recently, Peres summed up his belief that the future is built by people who first build their minds to have the capacity to dream big dreams.
We know that you have to eat 3 times a day. You eat 3 times a day, you get fat. I recommend read 3 times a day. You'll become wise. Better be wise than fat.
And how do you practice your brain?
By using it.
Shimon Peres dead at age 93, and that will not be the only reference to one's weight when it comes to wisdom or politics in this hour's program. It's not going to be the only reference to trust, either. Political leaders rely on trust to move voters. Shimon Peres certainly did, and they rely on the media to get their stories right. The media, in a time of extraordinary change right now, has a trust problem. We're halfway through our week-long examination of trust in America, Got Trust? Exploring Faith and Suspicion in the 21st Century. And gone are the days, you know this, when it was the voice of the most trusted man in America and his voice alone that narrated the most historically significant moments of our lives.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
The date's now indelible. It's going to be remembered as long as man survives. July 20th, 1969, the day man reached and walked on the moon.
Walter Cronkite from the days of three networks and one Walter. Today, only 20% of Americans have a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in the media, according to a June 2016 Gallup research poll. Margaret Sullivan is the Washington Post's media columnist, and she says the search for alternative media after the three-network era has led audiences into the wilderness with some very well-known examples.
There's a bigger thing that's changed. Families are not gathering around the television set every evening together the way they were at the time when Walter Cronkite was a famous anchorman. The news anchors simply don't have that kind of profile anymore because media has fractured so much and people are doing other things. Whether Brian Williams's exaggerations and so on really delivered some sort of a death blow to trust in TV news, I think it has more to do with the way the industry has changed.
One of those changes in the industry is the rise of Fox News, and whatever you want to say about its proclivity to Republican sources, et cetera, it seems to me a bigger story than that is the way Fox began its tone of addressing the nation as though there was an active conspiracy on the part of the mainstream media of liberals to delude America, and that drumbeat is every bit as much a part of how people think differently about the media as anything Fox may have done that's explicitly biased in their reporting. What would you say?
Absolutely. I think that you know, Fox was envisioned by Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes as an alternative to the mainstream media, and it has been, as you say, a constant drumbeat of these other media organizations are biased, they're liberal, they're elite, and we're giving you the straight scoop. And I think that, you know, you say something enough times and it begins to be believed. So I do think that they've changed politics and the view of the media very, very monumentally.
Perhaps Fox was moving news consumers into a zone that actually represents a certain amount of truth, in the sense that you have to consider the source, whoever it is you're listening to or reading, and that at a time when sources for media are so diverse, so extraordinarily diverse, you really can't trust anyone in particular without doing a lot of work. What does that say about the relationship between the media and news consumers in the 21st century?
What's happened is that news consumers have gone into their corners, I think. They have choices that provide sort of echo chambers. So if you're a Fox News viewer, you will get one sort of message, and if you're watching MSNBC, you're getting a very different kind of message, and these are self-reinforcing. And then, you know, we have social media in which you're getting what your friends and family members are sharing with you on Facebook. And if you don't make a huge effort, you will get a lot of the same point of view and never hear the other side. I think that's very worrisome and damaging.
Who can get authority if they're really looking for it as a news consumer? And what are they likely to find that, you know, will begin to, I guess, simulate what was once the unquestionable trust of the media a generation or two ago?
I think that news consumers have to be smart, and they have to spread their attention around more than they used to. I noticed the other day, and this became kind of a big thing, that there was a story in the trending topics on Facebook that Megyn Kelly was being fired from Fox. And, you know, it was at the top of the trending topics. It looked real. I looked at it, and I dug around just a little bit to see whether this was true. And I quickly realized that no reputable news organization had written this or aired it. And so I dismissed it. But I think that that's the kind of thing you have to actually begin to investigate and check when you see something that looks unlikely, and bring some skepticism and some news literacy to your consumption of news. I don't think everybody does that or could be expected to do it, but they can check with different news sources and not just stay within their own sort of comfort zone.
Margaret, thank you so much.
Thank you, John. This was great.
Margaret Sullivan is currently the media columnist for The Washington Post. So with trust in mind, who can decipher Donald Trump? It's a big question for the media, who have to figure this out and appear objective and not appear like some Washington leftist elite. Perhaps the best person to ask is someone who used to work for Donald Trump, Jerry Springer, the television host and former mayor of Cincinnati who once worked with Trump on his Miss Universe pageants. Springer is now a Hillary Clinton supporter and the current host of the Jerry Springer podcast, which, like his famous television show, provided an audience for the angry and passionate about America who aren't so concerned with being articulate and coherent in the way Hillary Clinton might understand. Springer finds Trump very familiar indeed.
Donald Trump isn't trying to win an argument in a sense on the intricacies of an issue. He's not reaching out to an audience that is reading policy papers. And I don't mean that in an elitist way. I mean, it could be of any income group. It's just people that aren't necessarily interested in what the particular solution is. It's just that they're upset with the way things are going. They're upset maybe with their own lives. Years ago, used to have, you know, we had television sets that if it suddenly started to go on the blink, you'd get up off the couch, you'd walk to the television set and whack the side of the TV set and you were ticked off, maybe right. even cursing as you were hitting it.
Uh-huh.
So you didn't really intellectually think that the problem would be permanently solved by a whack to the side of the TV set. It was just a temporary solution to express your, you know, you being upset with what's going on, and maybe it'll bring back a picture for a moment or two. And that's basically what he's doing to Washington, to the whole political environment. He's taking a baseball bat. He's, in a sense, being hired by angry people to, you know, we don't want to hear what the causes were, what the particular solution is. Just hit those damn people. And boom, the people that are that angry are enjoying that expression of anger at the moment. And he's just coming with a baseball bat.
So,
boom.
So it's Fonzie versus JFK here? I mean,
look, Donald Trump was inevitable. For at least the last 40 years, you know, and maybe it started with Goldwater, but certainly since Reagan. When Ronald Reagan said, government can't solve problems, government is the problem, we have raised two generations of Americans who believe that anything government does is horrible, all politicians are corrupt, the whole system is rigged against you, Washington is evil. And then every commercial we ever see politically, and frankly on both sides of the aisle, is how the other guy is a bum, the other guy should be in jail, the other guy is a pervert, whatever. Well, if you raise two generations of kids to believe that about our own government, about our own society, you can't then be surprised that eventually someone would run for president who is absolutely anti-government, anti-politician, anti-anything having to do with these social services. Now, in order to run for president, you have to be well known. Well, in American society, other than politics, the only two areas you can be well known in are either sports or entertainment. Well, athletes are too young to run for president, so we should have seen it coming that eventually someone would run for president who was an entertainer and totally against government and Washington. Did we know it'd be Trump? No, but it would be someone like him, and that's exactly what we're living with today. Donald Trump was inevitable.
Is he communicating? I mean, when he says thousands and thousands of companies are moving out of America,
well,
and he only cites one.
No one's, of course, you know, if you repeat a lie often enough, you know, if there are enough people that don't study any of this that, well, he said it, it must be true.
Jerry Springer, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
He's a former mayor of Cincinnati, host, of course, of the Jerry Springer Show and current host of the Jerry Springer podcast. He spoke with us from Cincinnati Public Radio. You can listen to my full interview with Jerry Springer at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom, providing resources to protect intellectual property, including trademark registration, copyrights, patents, and independent attorney consultations for advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
On Capitol Hill today, the big story, the Senate, a vote to override President Obama's veto of a bill to give relatives of survivors of the 9/11 terror attacks the ability to sue Saudi Arabia in court. It's an issue with connections to almost everything else going on in the government right now. The White House has raised concerns about how the legislation could lead to retaliation from foreign governments and further damage relations with the Saudi government. Saudi-U.S. relations are at a low ebb right now. 15 of the 19 hijackers in the 9/11 attacks were from Saudi Arabia, and that's widely known. Joining me now, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, the override is a significant setback for the White House policy?
No question about it, because, you know, President Obama has only issued a small handful of vetoes in his entire presidency. And this is looking like the first override, the Senate voting today. The House will vote by the end of the week. And they both passed this bill unanimously. John, it's just the culmination of years of erosion in the Saudi-U.S. relationship. And the Saudi government, through various agents, has been lobbying hard in Congress to avoid passage of this thing in the first place, which they failed on, of course, because it passed unanimously, and then to avoid this override. You go back to the Iran nuclear deal, which the Saudis see as a tilt toward Iran, which they don't like. The United States dealing with Iran and Russia in Syria, and tangentially dealing with Iran against ISIS in Iraq by, you know, activating the Shia militias in Iraq to fight against ISIS. And then the biggest blow just a month ago, the release of those 28 pages declassified from the 9/11 Commission report detailing contacts between Saudi government officials and their agents and some of the 9/11 hijackers going back before the attacks. Now, these votes passed in a huge way, and as I said, the Saudis have been lobbying hard against this, but all of the politics about this, especially in a late September in an election year, have just overwhelmed these efforts. And you say a defeat for the White House. Everyone from General Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, have warned that this could cause retaliatory lawsuits against U.S. personnel overseas. The White House argument, though, tacitly, John, is on another level. You know, the White House has to go to a putatively friendly foreign government like Saudi Arabia. Obama himself has acknowledged that the relationship with the Saudis is what he says complicated, and it sure is. It's been lousy lately. This adds a wrinkle to that. The White House doesn't have direct control over these lawsuits when they're filed, over discovery, over the politics of those lawsuits, and over the families. So when they've got to go in secret or on national security grounds to a government like Saudi Arabia and say, hey, can you help us out with this, you know, hypothetical secret foreign ops action, or help us lean on ISIS in this way, this is another lever that they can't control. And that helps explain why somebody like President Obama has been so against it.
Well, many people have pointed to the growing relationship with Iran as something that offends the Saudis and may even transform Iran into having the role that the Saudis formerly had, which would return the U.S. to a situation during the Shah, which goes way, way, way back. But this certainly complicates all of that. And I'm wondering if the flexing of Senate muscle here is also a sign that Congress has some government shutdown threats to attempt to make good on in this election month of 2016.
It's hard to tease out all of the different moving parts right before an election as Congress tries to race out of town to run for their own re-elections. But no shutdown alarms anymore, because they reached a deal late last night. There is a government funding bill, John, that runs out on Friday that got held up over a bunch of politics. Most recently, funding for Flint in Michigan for the water crisis there, holding up a deal between Republicans and Democrats. Look, there is almost, like, try to imagine an incentive if you're a voting member of Congress for a government shutdown now. We're almost into October in an election year. Nobody wants that. So they found a deal. What they're going to do is take $170 million for Flint, but they're going to tack it onto another bill that's moving, and they're going to pass a funding bill that keeps the government open. But you know I'm going to say they're not out of the woods. This only funds the government till December 19th. Luckily, that's after the election, so it takes some of the politics out of it. But by that time, they'll have to do a massive omnibus government funding bill. By then, we should know, luckily, who the next president will be and what the makeup of the next Congress is. So that'll shift things around a bit. But for now, they have a deal.
Deciphering the priorities of Congress, always a challenge, particularly challenging in this month of September. Is Schumer taking this as a first step towards a broader sense of doing foreign policy in the civil court system, with maybe Schumer hiring the lawyers?
You have Chuck Schumer of New York, of course, and behind that question, John, is that Chuck Schumer of New York is the next Democratic leader of the Senate, maybe the next majority leader if Democrats succeed in taking over here. And he has been the major ballast, the major pushback against President Obama on this issue. Look, he's the senator from New York. You can see why the entire New York delegation has been for this, because of the 9/11 families, largely from New York and New Jersey. So this can be seen as the first flex of new leader Schumer, but we don't know yet whether he'll be majority leader or minority leader next January.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, back in Washington, taking care of all the business on Capitol Hill. Thanks so much, Todd.
You got it, John.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. So Steve Vladeck, law professor at the University of Texas, With Todd Zwillich's analysis in mind, what's the chance that this vote on Saudi Arabia will be anything other than symbolic, which could also make the United States vulnerable to similar retaliatory lawsuits for American actions abroad?
The best case scenario, and I think the scenario envisioned by its sponsors, is that JASTA will clear away all of these obstacles that courts have found over the last 11 years, stand in the way of the families of 9/11 victims and the victims themselves actually having the courts reach the merits of their claims and try to get to the bottom of whether Saudi Arabia was somehow indirectly responsible for the 9/11 attacks. Those claims haven't gotten to the merits so far because of all of these different procedural blocks.
A much more significant issue, it seems to me, is the liability of the United States potentially in like drone attacks on civilians. The question of civilian collateral damage going all the way back to the Vietnam War. And this just seems like it opens a huge number of issues that the United States would be exposed to.
Even if the bill is only symbolic, even if at the end of the day there isn't going to be a meaningful opportunity for relief against Saudi Arabia, there's still the symbolic harm and there's still the very real possibility that other countries will follow the United States' lead and relax their own sovereign immunity rules in cases that they deem to be acts of terrorism.
Has anyone ever had any success in civil court on an international case like this?
So there are examples under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act of some plaintiffs at least obtaining judgments against countries that have been designated state sponsors of terrorism, like Iran. There's been difficulties executing those judgments. So the plaintiffs have had a devil of a time getting any money, but they've at least been able to obtain judicial rulings that Iran was in the wrong for sponsoring acts of terrorism and so on. That's a big part of what the plaintiffs are looking for in these cases. It's not about the money. It's about the principle.
What if politically it was very different? What if the White House and Senator Schumer and Cornyn saw eye to eye on all of this, and there was a absolute consensus from the top down in the U.S. government that we got to go after the Saudis with everything we can? Would there actually be leverage that the U.S. would have to compel something out of Saudi Arabia?
So I think there would be leverage, but I think that civil suits by private plaintiffs may not be the best way to obtain that leverage. And I think in the Saudi case, if the executive branch really wanted to turn the screws on the Saudi government, this would not be the way they went about it. They would do it on their own through the Treasury Department by looking at the interaction between us and the Saudis when it comes to financial support. The problem with opening the door to civil liability is that it takes the diplomatic relations piece out of the executive branch's hand and puts it in the hand of individual plaintiffs and individual district judges. We may very well think in the context of the 9/11 attacks and in the context of these particular plaintiffs, that would be worth it. But then this is the wrong bill because it doesn't actually provide those plaintiffs with what they're really looking for.
He teaches law at the University of Texas School of Law. Steve Vladeck joined us from KUT in Austin. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
The story for the chicken in the supermarket, of course, we all know, is a grim one.
When you eat a Purdue chicken, you have no idea how much work has gone into it. My son Frank eats, sleeps, and breathes chicken. He works inhuman hours, 15, 16 hours a day, to bring you the quality you've come to expect from Purdue. You might wonder what drives a man like this. I'll tell you, me.
Arthur Perdue founded Perdue Farms with his wife Pearl in their backyard in 1920, eventually growing it into a $4.1 billion company. The industrialization of meat production scaled up so that it can deliver 56 billion farmed animals per year, turning backyards into factories. But what about the workers? It's the subject of Ellen Silbergeld's new book, Chickenizing Farms and Food, How Industrial Meat Production Endangers Workers, Animals, and Consumers. Silbergeld argues that we put food safety ahead of worker safety It's something that hasn't changed in nearly 100 years since Arthur Perdue's day. How these workers, like Arthur's son, Frank, are treated, and how the multi-billion-dollar industry is regulated.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture had funded research to develop a chicken that would be tenderer than the retired layers, which is what people used to eat. Those were the days of boiled chicken. So that was one contribution. The other was, some people will say, a kind of excess labor force in certain parts of the country was certainly related to the growth of transportation. And then there were at least a couple of really extraordinary innovators who saw an opportunity to radically transform agriculture. And that's what the USDA means by the word chickenizing. Some people have asked me, but wait, aren't there other animals that are grown by this method? And I say, yes. But it's actually a USDA term that, if you will, pays homage to the primacy of the transformation in chicken production. And I first came across it, I saw a book called Chickenization of Pork Production.
Oh,
and I
God.
Thought at first, is this some kind of genetic engineering? But that's when I learned what it was.
What was the main innovation that Perdue and Tyson were able to put out in the field and make a reality for the poor chickens?
I think the main one was that Perdue first figured out the key place to position yourself was to own the slaughterhouses, because then you're in a position of setting the price, and you also settle the cost that you're going to charge the wholesaler and the retailer. And that was the real innovation. And he focused all his design, management, and economic innovations on the slaughterhouse.
What's it like to witness firsthand one of these hugely scaled operations, whether it's beef, pork, or chicken?
It makes you weep for the people who work there. And this is really the forgotten part of this whole story, you know, and that goes all the way back to Upton Sinclair. When he wrote The Jungle, and it caused an immediate stir and rapid response from Washington, the pure food and drug laws that were passed in 1907. But Sinclair, when he was asked about this, you know, aren't you proud that you made this wonderful change? He said, no. I aimed at the heart and somehow hit the stomach, because that book is about workers. And in fact, when I gave a copy of The Jungle to one of the labor union leaders that we've worked with, I remember he came storming out of his office with The Jungle in his hand. He said to me, when was this book written? And I said, 1904. And he looks at me and says in a really loud voice, nothing has changed. Nothing has changed since this. Then he looked at me and said, I know it sounds corny, he said, you must write a book.
What are the conditions that most threaten workers, and what have you seen in terms of workers who were actually injured or perhaps even killed on the job?
The most vivid picture I saw was when we were down in Columbia, South Carolina, doing a study at a poultry processing plant, and one of them showed up wearing a black plastic trash bag. And I said, Charlie, why are you wearing a black trash bag? He said, this is the protective equipment they give me. But I think if people understood that a slaughterhouse gets washed down once a day, and for certain hog plants, there can be as many as 30,000 animals that come through in that day, you can imagine how effective it is to clean it up once.
What would get, do you think, the American public to be concerned about workers in the meat production industry? Because Americans are biased toward the issue of pathogens and less interested in the workers.
Well, I'm hoping, because I have a chapter on worker safety before the chapter on food safety. My observations are that these two are absolutely linked, and the practices that are allowed in slaughterhouses and, in fact, on farms result in unsafe food. So if you care about food safety, you have to care about worker safety. 98% of the chickens produced in the United States today come out of the factory system. So we can go to the farmer's market, but we're doing nothing for the health of our country. So we're really all part of this problem.
What policy solutions would rectify the situation for that 98% without raising the price of chicken so high or making it unavailable that the access to chicken and meat as we know it would be a thing of the past?
What we have to do is recognize we need high production agriculture. All the CSAs, all the organic farms in this country could not feed most of the cities in this country. So this has nothing to do with a viable food system for all. What we need to do is something much more difficult, which is to say we have an industrial production system that is out of control, and now we need to reform it. You know, in 1923, we invented cars. Well, in 1925, we put lead in the gasoline of cars. Not a great decision. By 1970, we realized that the engines were so inefficient that they were creating really dangerous smog situations in L.A. and other major cities. Did we go back to the horse and buggy? No. We took lead out of gasoline, we mandated reform of the engine and fuels, and now cars come mandatorily equipped with seat belts and airbags. So we have to adopt that same attitude to the situation we have with food.
Ellen Silbergeld is a professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and author of Chickenizing Farms and Food, How Industrial Meat Production Endangers Workers, Animals, and Consumers. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Look in the mirror, you see yourself, but if you're above a size 14, as most women are, do you see yourself in movies, TV, and ads in print and on the internet?
Hi, my name is Sina. No, I am 5'11". My measurements are 54, 44, 53, and there is nothing comparable out there in the media. I would love to see somebody who has proportions relative to mine, and I'd love to be able to find clothes to fit.
This is Ann Fuller calling from Eugene, Oregon. Never. I see no one in regular life who looks like people depicted in media. This phenomenon leads to an unhealthy disconnect and disparagement of regular human bodies.
Call us with your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. The late Shimon Peres' advice we played earlier this hour, read three times a day instead of eating three times a day. It's better to be wise than fat. The line got a laugh when Peres said it years ago. But the same sentiment in a much nastier context was part of the Clinton-Trump debate this week.
One of the worst things he said was about a woman in a beauty contest. He loves beauty contests, supporting them and hanging around them. And he called this woman Miss Piggy.
Donald Trump's response the next day? Let's just say not an apology. Here he is calling into the Fox News show Fox and Friends.
She was a Miss Universe contestant and ultimately a winner who they had a tremendously difficult time with as Miss Universe. She was the winner and, you know, she gained a massive amount of weight and it was a real problem.
Most women in the U.S. are above a size 14 in clothes, 67% to be exact. But just 2% of women shown in media images are anything other than skinny. Retailers like Macy's offer only 15.6% of garments at so-called plus size. For JCPenney's, it's 16.1%. A lifestyle and fashion blog, Refinery29, along with Getty Images, is launching Project 67%, a bid to get a greater variety of body types into the media and make their collection of photos available to media outlets to close what they call the representation gap. But Amanda Cherniowski, who worked for 2.5 years as a model and wrote a book, Fashioning Fat, Inside Plus-Size Modeling, says more images will help. But for her, it's a real head-scratcher how much money is being wasted on racks of clothes most women simply can't wear.
It's a $20-plus billion opportunity for designers, and they are not cashing in. And I would argue that it's because of fear. And there are two dimensions of this fear. The first element, a fear of the stigma of fat, not wanting their clothes to be on people that they don't think are good enough to wear their clothes. And we saw these infamous cases with Karl Lagerfeld, with Mike Jeffries of Abercrombie & Fitch. But also the second element is a fear of failure. Because the fact of the matter is, it's actually more difficult to design a garment for a plus-size body because it comes in so many different shapes. And design schools are not preparing their students for this.
So if you are going to a retailer and you have, you know, a demand for something higher than a size 14, what predicament are you finding on the rack?
Well, you're finding a lack of clothing. There are no options in store or very few. Or you have to go online. And the problem is, women need to try on clothes because sizes mean nothing. There's no standardization at all in the industry. What one designer calls a size 8 could be a size 12 in another designer. And so it brings another level of inconvenience for the consumer. And that's why a lot of plus-size women themselves are going into the design field because they're frustrated with their own shopping experience. I can't find things that are on trend. I can't find things that flatter my particular body type. So I'm going to make clothes for myself. And because of the internet, they can. And so you see a burgeoning area of online plus-size boutiques emerging.
What's going to change this broadly? Is it a matter of more images of women who are plus sized? I mean, what would you make of, for instance, the campaign by Dove that's been around for a while now?
Yeah, the Dove campaign has been around for many, many years now. And it really hasn't been until the last couple of years that we've seen the focus on the plus size sector of the fashion world. I mean, 2015 was huge. So the hope is that this continues and it's not just a media spectacle, a spectacle to just boost sales temporarily, but it becomes normalized.
What do you think of this lifestyle and fashion blog company, Refinery29, that's working with, you know, major photo outlets, Getty Images, to create an archive of plus size images that would appear, you know, outside of fashion, that would appear in other sorts of contexts to remind people of, you know, who the majority actually is?
Right. I think it's a great initiative to make visible that invisible majority, because we don't see larger bodies anywhere, even within the plus size sector of the fashion world. The types of plus size bodies we see are at the smaller end of the spectrum, the size 10s, 12s, maybe 14. So even trying to expand the plus size definition itself would be a huge step.
Isn't the domination of certain women in the fashion journalism industry part of the problem? I mean, I can imagine Anna Wintour, you know, at Vogue, looking at one of these plus size images and going, well, it's fine, but, you know, isn't she a little, you know what I mean, big? I mean,
fat.
Right,
you
exactly.
Can say fat.
Exactly. I mean, I feel as though there's such a, I mean, maybe there's this archive, but will anyone actually use it?
I hope they will. I hope that, you know, we've had a broadening of our perspectives and an increase in the conversation that people are more willing to say that, hey, you know, this is the reality. They just released a report that no longer are the average American woman a size 14, but somewhere now a 16, 18. Mm. So the reality is, you know what? We are larger. Get with the program.
What's the sociological dimension of this, since you are a professor of sociology at Temple University?
You know, it really has a lot to do with the stigma, you know, the stigma of fat. We are so afraid. It's one of those other dirty F words in our culture. And we have to fight against that. Get over it. Get over ourselves.
What did you make of Donald Trump being a boor here and talking about the weight gain of a Miss Universe contestant?
Well, I must tell you, when I was a little girl, seeing the headlines about a Miss Universe winner who was ridiculed for her weight gain and possibly could have lost her crown, I was appalled. But now, having seen the insides of the fashion industry for my research for my book, I understand.
Do you think women will punish Donald Trump politically for the Miss Universe statements? And will they punish him any more than some of the other statements he's made about women?
I think those kinds of statements where you're disparaging a woman for their body, I think that women will take great offense to that, because women are judged greatly for their looks, for their bodies. That's one thing that women are taught to be very critical of. And so they don't want to hear any person criticizing another for their bodies or for their looks. So there could be some pushback because of that.
Dr. Amanda Chernyowski is the author of Fashioning Fat, Inside Plus-Size Modeling. She's also Associate Professor of Sociology at Temple University in Philadelphia. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you very much.
My name is Desi Conrad, and I live in South Carolina. And my body type is never reflected in media. Even plus-size models, who I should add, aren't plus-size, don't have my body type. Fashion regularly doesn't fit me, and media regularly makes me feel really terrible about my figure and the way I look.
Savannah, Georgia, I constantly struggle with the idea of how I should look. In college, I was hospitalized for anorexia, and I am saddened to admit that I've passed this anxiety on to my children. Our number is 877-8-MY-TAKE. Comment on Facebook at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.